Reactor online. Sensors online. Weapons online. All systems nominal.
Hello, everyone. Carrie, your favorite Canopian cat girl here with the Unicorn Company podcast. There has been a lot going on lately in the news surrounding the community as well as the game itself. With that being in mind, let's get into the news. Haven't done this in a little while, right? In the first quarter, we have the Star League Command Lance that I mentioned in the last episode. We also have them aiming for a March or April release for the 40th anniversary versions of the Beginner's Box and a game of Armored Combat. It is my understanding that the minis in these will not be changing, but will have new 40th anniversary edition art on the covers of the boxes. The Kickstarter fulfillment looks like it will also be coming possibly in the first quarter. It has also been announced that they will be including a box with four Savannah Master hovercraft, so that is pretty awesome. In May, we should be getting Force Manual Davian and Force Manual Davian. I miswrote that. Oh no, Force Manual Davian Ilclan supplement. Okay. Quarter two looks like it will be bringing legendary battle mats, Misery and Thunder Rift, as well as a City Lunar Mat, Recognition Guide Volume 2 Ilclan print book, and the BattleTech Universe. I was going to say University. The BattleTech Universe book, as well as the second Star League Lance. In the third quarter, we have quite a number of releases. Force Manual Karita, along with an Ilclan supplement. They are looking at releasing a set of technical blueprints and possibly a Mercenaries Force Manual with an Ilclan supplement for that as well. We should also see the third Star League Striker Star, and they also announced a McCarran's Armored Cavalry Assault Lance with a target of September for the book Hotspots Hinterlands as well. Finally, in the fourth quarter, we have the BattleTech Cookbook, Brush Wars, and it is planned that we will have another force pack. This one hasn't been specifically announced, though. So that covers everything for the news. Let's go ahead and move on to our main subject today. All right, so today's subject is going to be a little different. With all the real-world conflict in the community, I want to talk about something in the universe. I want to take time today on a leap year. So this episode, the weird stuff from the inner sphere and periphery, will probably be a four-year thing. But I want to take time to talk to you about it and distract you from the troubles and the things going on, but I want to talk about the strange and sometimes wonderful things in the inner sphere and beyond. The idea for this was inspired by my cat, Itty. Say hi, Itty. Barely says hi. And I began to idly wonder about jump ship cats or space cats. Where was I? As a cat person, they intrigue me. So we don't have a wealth of information on them, except that they are an offshoot of the cats from pre-spaceflight Terra. Now, some might think it odd to have cats on a jump ship, but it is traditional of navies to have cats as they help to control pests. And with drop ships going between planets or even between jump ships, it is definitely possible that pests can move from worlds to ships, or even from ship to ship. Over time, the cats have become more adapted to their environment, living their entire lives, or most of it, in the case of cats on warships, in almost zero G. They have become lighter than their earthbound cousins, immune to space sickness, and generally more adept in moving around in low gravity. On top of this, as kittens, they have magnets glued to their paws, which allow them to walk on virtually any surface in the jump ship. These magnets are permanently implanted after they reach a certain age. Now, there are certain technical issues that do come to mind concerning jump ships that don't have grav decks. And what the cat has to do in, that situation. And yes, you probably had that thought for a moment too. So, while we're on the subject of jump ships, let's talk about a group that spends much of their life on the jump ship. This would be the Yarnfolk, or Iron People. The Yarnfolk are a loosely organized deep periphery nation, which officially is ruled by a council, although actual power lays with the nine families or clans in Yarnfolk society. The families are spread over four worlds in the deep periphery, which are Coreward of the Outworlds Alliance, later the Raven Alliance, and Spinward of the Draconis Combine. While their society is primarily agricultural, they do have some industrial capacity, and they seem able to maintain their fleets of jump ships, as well as produce exquisite small arms. Now, first we should explain the jump ships. The Yarnfolk are a spacefaring civilization, and each clan maintains a trading fleet. These ships are painted with, I'm going to mispronounce this, I know it, Urnes style patterns, which date back to the 11th and 12th century of pre-spaceflight Terra, and are slim and stylized animals. These animals, which generally have their head in profile, are depicted in tight patterns. The nine clans of the Yarnfolk own fleets of jump ships. While it is unknown how many jump ships each clan owns, it is likely safe to speculate that each fleet is relatively small. The Yarnfolk use these jump ships for trade, and serving on them is something seen as a great honor, almost like being a mech warrior in the Succession Wars 3025 era and so forth. The Yarnfolk occupy four worlds, which I will now butcher the names of. They are Hofung, Aalborg, Hamar, and Trondheim. Each world is generally agrarian, with small amounts of heavy industry, which is capable of making pistols, and they are renowned for their excellent craftsmanship. As far as the scope of the trading performed by the Yarnfolk, even though they are Spinward of the Draconis Combine, their trade ships are known to go as far as the Hanseatic League, which is beyond the Lyran Commonwealth / Alliance, depending on when it is. And even that now is different because it's the Scorpion Empire. So I'm assuming that you see them in the Scorpion Empire at this point. While most worlds that traders... Yeah. While most would think that traders encountering a periphery clan that has morphed into some kind of empire may be dangerous, the Yarnfolk have encountered the clans as far back as 2981, when one of their ships was seized, inspected, and subsequently released as the clans saw the Yarnfolk as harmless and not a threat. They weren't even worth taking as bondsmen. This assessment is pretty on the nose, though, as they don't engage in large-scale warfare. Instead, they have duels when there are blood feuds between clans. While this has led to worlds that have not seen wars, as the Inner Sphere has been constantly seeing since the Periphery Uprising, this and their culture has led to something of a mercenary offshoot. Since Comstar's Explorers Corps first made contact with them sometime after that, the Yarnfolk kill teams may have started working as assassins in the Inner Sphere during the 3060s. And these kill teams are made up of former bodyguards for the clan heads. And they have nowhere to ply their trades, so the newly opened Inner Sphere makes a great place for them to do it. Now, another oddity of the periphery is a world only two jumps from the Yarnfolk, known as Alfberk. This little place has somehow not been discovered by them or most anyone else, except, of course, by Comstar. The world of Alfurk was colonized by a jump ship that only made five jumps from Terra. The first four went as planned, but the fifth was a massive misjump that threw them around 600 light years off course. As this happened before HPG generators existed, and with their jump ship damaged, the colonists thought little of their of their situation, and so thrived on their adopted world. Generally, life progressed normally for them until in 2963, a plague began afflicting their population. They repaired their jump ship and started heading back for Terra to get help. Luckily or unluckily, depending on your point of view, they encountered a Comstar Explorer Corps vessel and were able to receive medical aid from them. Comstar provided them something else, though, propaganda. They warned them of pirates, and then about the greed of the successor states, and eventually, the aggressive and conquering clans. This has developed into a society that is now ever vigilant, as all they know of the outside universe was spoon-fed to them by Comstar. And what Comstar was feeding them was fear. Now, one last story that I want to talk about is the story of Captain James Cromwell and the Starleague ship Manassas. Cromwell was the hero of Camp Somerset during the Starleague Civil War and commanded the Lionhearts, a unit known for its completion of missions that bordered on suicidal, and were able to survive through their grit and cunning. The Lionhearts were thought to have joined Kerensky on his exodus, though modern historians find it baffling that given his bravery, he did not become a member of the clans, as there is no record of a Cromwell blood name ever existing. Now, the rest of what I'm going to tell you comes from information once again leaked since the fall of Comstar and Clan Novacat. Because this information has come to light, rewrites part of history that includes not only our view of Captain Cromwell, but also the history of a little-known ship, the Manassas. The Manassas was a one-of-a-kind vessel, formerly an Aegis-class ship. She became the first and only of her class, which bore her name. The Manassas was outfitted with a jump drive that allowed it to jump up to 40 light years, 10 more than a conventional drive. She did, in fact, leave with Kerensky and, through a misjump, ended up reappearing in the Schwartz system in 3058. In the middle of the clan invasion. Reports indicate that she soon jumped away and before later reappearing and engaging the Smoke Jaguar warship on station. This is where our story gets really interesting, though. You see, there are a few different rumors as to what happened to the ship. Some believe it was captured by the Jaguars, and some horrible fate befell the crew of the ship out of time. Some believe the Comstar account that was found, which states the Lionhearts became a part of Comstar or prisoners in a gilded cage, and the Manassas was destroyed. Finally, there are people like me. People that think that Comstar was able to either capture the ship or at least get its technical specifications for that new jump drive. And the Lionhearts were taken, interrogated, and finally liquidated when they had been used to get all the information the Comstar could. In support of this, I point to the supposed super jump drives of the Word of Blake, as the specifications could have led to them, and they developed the drive further. In the end, though, no one knows the true fate of the Manassas, her crew, the Lionhearts, or even Captain Cromwell. His fate in all this has been the worst of all, as a man who was regarded as a hero by the Inner Sphere, and through time and a simple misjump, was eventually recorded, once again by Comstar, to be a glory hound, an inept leader, and he likely died in an interrogation room in a time he didn't even understand. Okay, so before we get into today's Mech Tech segment, I want to go ahead and talk about our sponsor, Fortress Miniatures and Games. You can find them at fortressminiaturesandgames.com. They have been helping us with getting product to review, which you can find over on our YouTube channel, Unicorn Company Podcast. And they're awesome. They have just about anything you would need for Battletech. They have everything from dice and terrain to metal and the plastic miniatures. They do sell the plastic miniatures separately, so depending on their stock levels, they will have the plastic miniatures from the box sets, from the force packs, and they also carry the Catalyst premium miniatures as well. So check out Fortress Miniatures and Games for any of your Battletech needs. And now let's go ahead and get into our MechTech segment. For our MechTech segment today, we will be talking about the Bombardier, as it is one of the weird designs of the Inner Sphere and of the Star League. To understand this mech, you have to understand something about the society that built it. Now, the Bombardier was first built in 2735 in the last few years of Jonathan Cameron's reign, when the state was being run in his stead by his sister, Jocasta. Development would have started earlier, though, and with Jonathan's ever-increasing paranoia about the periphery, he was constantly looking for an edge. This is where Wakizashi Enterprises steps in and introduces what they refer to as an artillery mech. The machine that Wakizashi delivered, though, had a very strong resemblance to an already existing, almost 300-year-old platform, the Archer. The mission profiles and loadouts were eerily similar, and in fact, to the untrained eye, one might mistake a Bombardier for an Archer variant. In fact, when designing a Royal variant of a fire support missile platform in 2752, a mere 17 years after the release of the Bombardier, it was decided by the SLDF that instead of a mech, which the SLDF had been saddled with hundreds of, they went with the Archer. This only served to cement the Bombardier with a bad reputation, as it was seen as so inferior that a design almost three centuries old was chosen for royal upgrades, and not it. Additionally, neither the SLDF nor Wakizashi would develop any variants of the design. Eventually, Earthworks would gain a license to build the maligned machine during the Succession Wars. The mech, which was already seen as inferior, was further downgraded and was essentially an Archer knockoff at this point. The design would eventually see a brief renaissance after the Clan invasion with significant technology and weapons upgrades. Now, the base model of the Bombardier that we all know, or it's possible many of you don't know, is the BMB-12D. This is the baseline model and comes in at 65 tons. The mech does place an emphasis on speed using a Vox 325 extra light engine It is capable of speeds of up to 86 kilometers an hour. The bombardier is protected by a very respectable 12 and a half tons of armor. This protection is enhanced with an anti-missile system, which helps protect it from enemy missile attacks. For offensive armament, it carries a pair of long-range missile 20 racks, one in each side torso, and a single short-range missile 4 rack in its right arm. The SRM launcher has plentiful reloads with 1 ton of ammunition, yet the LRM-20s have 1 ton each, limiting it to 12 salvos, which is ironic as it was marketed as being able to use a variety of specialized munitions while limited in its ability to do so. The bombardier is cooled by 10 double heat sinks, which give the mech excellent cooling capabilities. Now, the downgraded Earthworks variant, the 10D, was introduced in 2866 and removes much of what made the bombardier unique. The speed of the mech has been reduced to 64 kilometers an hour, and its anti-missile system, as well as its cellular ammunition storage, has been removed. The AMS was replaced with a machine gun, making it more effective against infantry, and the double heat sinks had been replaced with single versions, making it struggle with its weapons heat in comparison to the 12D. The model shows how austerity downgrades had to be made to Star League machines as the Inner Sphere had been bombing itself back into the Stone Age at this point. The next few upgrades show the post-clan invasion renaissance that the bombardier enjoyed. The first of these is the 14C variant. This model is an upgrade of the original by Comstar. As such, they stripped out the anti-missile system and the SRM-4. The AMS was replaced with an ER small laser and an improved C3 computer. Well, the C3 computer, it's in the center torso, allowing the mech to share targeting data with up to 5 other mechs, as long as they also carry a C3i computer. Additionally, the LRMs have been enhanced through the addition of Artemis IV fire control systems and now carries double the number of reloads for the launchers. One could theorize that had the Star League survived, a similar variant may have eventually been designed by them. In 3070, the Outworlds Alliance would actually turn the bombardier into an artillery mech, allowing it to live up to the title Wakizashi had given it. This model retains the speed of the original, as well as the armor and heat sinks. To upgrade it, though, they stripped out all of the weapons except the anti-missile system. The weapons payload now centers on an Arrow 4 artillery missile system with 20 reloads. This system takes up the entire left arm and part of the left torso. The O5A also carries a small laser in the left torso. The mech carries 3 rocket launcher 20 racks in its right arm. These are one-shot weapons but serve as a deterrent in case anyone attempts to close with the mech. The last of the bombardier upgrades is the 14K model. This variant truly turns the bombardier into a mech that uses multiple missile types in its own unique way. It is almost identical, in most respects, to the base model except the weapons and armor. The armor is upgraded by 0.5 ton, and all of the weapons have been removed for more modern equipment. First, the C3 slave computer has been added, allowing it to share targeting telemetry as part of a standard C3 network. The right arm SRM-4 has been replaced with 3 machine guns and a machine gun array, making them much more effective. In place of the LRM launchers, the 14K carries 4 multi-missile launcher 7 racks with 2 in each side torso. While not sending as many missiles downrange, they are capable of firing either long or short-range missiles, giving the design incredible flexibility. They are plentifully supplied with 5 tons of ammunition. So, I mean, looking at it in Classic, the Bombardier, it's a weird mech. It's an oddball. It was designed to do the Archer's job in the same time period that the Archer was around and very effective. You might say that it did lead to the development of the Royal Archer, but in my opinion, the Royal Archer was developed because the Bombardier was seen to be ineffective in comparison to the expectations that were had by the SLDF. So now that we've looked at it in its classic BattleTech form, let's go ahead and take a moment to look at this mech in Alpha Strike. All right, so getting into the Alpha Strike bombardiers. So the first one we're going to be looking at here is the Star League era variant, the BMB-12D Bombardier. This mech comes in at 39 points. It's type battle mech, size 3, with a TMM of 2 and a movement of 10. Its role is missile boat. As far as firepower, it's a little underwhelming. It's a 2 at short, 3 at medium, 2 at long, no overheat value. Now, for armor, you do have 7 armor and you have 3 structure because of the extra light engine. Specials on this are anti-missile system, case, indirect fire 2, and LRM 122. Not an overwhelming machine, but it's basically a long-range soldier mech at this point, and a little pricey at that for being one. Then we have the BMB-10D Bombardier. This one comes in at 35 points and is the Succession Wars downgrade. Battle mech, size 3, TMM1 with a movement of 8. It is once again a missile boat. And I think I mentioned 35 points for this one. It is short, medium, and long of 2 with an overheat of 1, which ironically gives it slightly more firepower at short range if it overheats than the 12D. It has armor of 7 once again, and this time it has structure of 5. The specials on this are identical almost. It drops the AMS in case, so you're left with the IF2, and the LRM is 112 in this case. After that, we get into the BMB-14C. It's a 47-point version of the Bombardier, which is a little bit pricier than the two older ones. It's a battle mech, size 3, TMM of 2, 10-inch movement. It's a missile boat, and it has 2 at short range. Medium and long, though, it has 4. So this is an excellent long-range platform for its price. No overheat value. This one has 7 armor and 3 structure. And of course, you'd probably want to be playing Comstar for this, so you'd have access to C3I, because it does have that. It also has case, indirect fire 2, and mech headquarter 2. And with its firepower profile, the damage profile, being part of a C3I unit would be optimal for this because you could keep it in the backfield while lighter, faster units that can scout. And also have C3I could get you really good short and medium range targeting data, and you just stand still and lob missiles. The next one we're looking at, the BMB 05A or 05A, this is that Outworlds Alliance artillery version of the Bombardier. This one comes in at 39 points. It's a battle mech, size 3, TMM of 2 with a 10-inch move. So it has a really good movement profile for being an artillery mech. It's a missile boat. It has a short of 1, a 0, or sorry, a medium of 0 with an asterisk, and a long of 0 with no overheat. Now, once again, your armor is 7, your structure is 3. It has the anti-missile system. It also has artillery, aero, inner sphere 1, and it has case. So this is roughly on par with something like the catapult. Has a lot more protection than the Aero 4 urban mech, obviously. And depending on how vulnerable you'll expect your backfield units to get, it may or may not be to its benefit having as much armor as it does. So that's sort of and the mobility. I'm sure pretty much if it ends up needing to go and run and gun, it's got that ability to run and gun, but it's only going to be doing 2 points of damage if you're direct firing Aero 4. And then finally, we have the BMB 14K, the bombardier that was created by House Kurita and brings the other aspect of what Wakizashi promised, a mech that used multiple munitions. This is 43 points. It's a battle mech, size 3, TMM2, movement of 10, missile boat, and has a short of 4, a medium of 3, and a long of 2 with no overheat. This reflects the ability to switch to short-range missiles at close use a mix at medium and just have the long range missiles at long, obviously. Armor on this is 7, structure is 3. The specials that it has is a C3 slave, obviously useful if you're going to use a C3 lance. This one doesn't benefit as much because of the fact that its long range firepower is lower than its short. So this is going to want to be closer than the Comstar version. Indirect fire 2, LRM of nil 1-2. I think it's the first time I've seen that. Mech headquarter 1, and SRM of 3/1. I don't so much care for the... You're paying for the special abilities. Just put it this way. And because you're paying for the special abilities, you're paying a tax on the mech that it doesn't get to use. And that tax is the LRM and the SRM special. In casual play, obviously, it's not really a tax, because you can take armor piercing, you can take flechette, you can take infernos. The flechette, I think, is LRM, the rest is SRM. You can take semi-guided LRMs. You have options out there for the weapons packages that you can put on this as far as your ammunition loads. In competitive play, which is mainly where I exist with Alpha Strike, those stats are ignored. And I feel like that's something that needs to be addressed in competitive play, simply because you have a situation where you're paying for abilities that you don't get to use. Like the MHQ-1 does not come in up in competitive Alpha Strike. I feel like it should be something that comes up simply because the concept of the mech headquarters gives you a bonus to your initiative rolls in casual, but it doesn't in competitive. Same with the LRM and SRM stat. It's a bonus in casual. Like one of my favorite loadouts to take is the Vulture Mark III with the, oh God, what is it? There's one that has like SRM 4-4-0, or it might be 3-3-0, but it is terrifying if you throw armor-piercing missiles in there, because every time you hit, you get to try for a critical. That just does not happen in competitive. And I understand you want to keep things simple, but at the same time, I think that you would want to enhance those abilities as well. You would want to make it more... You want to make it where players are using skill, not skills, but characteristics that they're paying for. So that's pretty much my take on it. As far as overall, the Bombardier is a decent platform in some of its loadouts for Alpha Strike, especially the 14C, which, like I said, excellent long-range sniper. The standard 12D is not so great. And if you're playing 30-25 games, the 10D is actually not too bad. It suffers from some problems, I will admit that. But overall, for being from that era, it's essentially the same thing as an Archer, just a little bit different in the loadout. So that is everything for our Mech Tech segment today. I do want to go ahead and let you know that if you do like this and you are listening on YouTube, then go ahead, hit a like, give it a like, subscribe to the channel. It always helps us out when we're getting more people on board. We know we're seeing that audience grow. Also, if you want to consider supporting us more, then I would greatly suggest going to our Patreon at patreon.com/unicorncompany. There at the $5 tier and up, you will get the YouTube videos. I try to make sure that I give access to those before they come out. I also try to make sure that we can get some polls in every now and then on things that I might review or subjects or stuff like that. And there are other things I try to do for the channel as well on there. So go ahead and check that out. And, if you want to help us be able to get better equipment, get more stuff to review, and get more content out there, that's probably the best way to help us do that. So I want to thank everybody for listening today. I want to thank our patrons. I want to thank our sponsor, Fortress Miniatures and Games. And this is Carrie signing off. I'm gonna find my meaning, I can make a change, I wanna play.